You're listening to a Frequency Podcast Network production.
Church had just let out when a horse-drawn wagon creaked and clopped down a dusty street in downtown Chicago. Two men sat side by side on its weather-beaten seat, one clutching the reins, the other holding a leather doctor bag in his lap. It was just after 11 o'clock in the morning on Sunday, June 13th, 1880. The sun shone on the shoulders of a crowd that stood near one of the slanting shacks that lined the street. Their excited voices cut through the sound of a steam train chuffing its way through the rail yard a few houses down. The wagon jerked to a stop outside the house, and Officer Taylor of the Chicago Police Department stepped from the gloomy entryway into the sunlight. Dr. Adams leapt down from the wagon and was quickly ushered inside. When the rickety wooden door slammed shut, the officer turned to the crowd to continue his investigation. Did anyone know the woman who lived there? Did she have any friends or family who could take charge of the body? Nothing but shrugs, shaken heads, and blank stares. Did anyone know if she had been sick? Had they seen anything suspicious? After several fruitless minutes, the doctor reappeared and gave an estimated time of death for the police report. It would have been close to 8 in the morning, shortly after one passerby had seen her shuffling past the windows. Her body was cold by the time she was discovered. The officer turned to the wagon's driver and told him to call on the county undertaker and ask him to get ready to make one more addition to Potter's Field. But as the driver snapped the reins and the crowd thinned, a rumor began to swirl. The woman lying dead at number 64 School Street was not the kind of person who would normally be bound for the graveyard of the poor and disenfranchised. She had the height and the natural beauty of one who had been well nourished when she was young, and to those who briefly spoke to her when she was alive, she seemed surprisingly well educated. She was, they said, a member of the upper class, the daughter of a man who was, at one time, one of Toronto's wealthiest citizens. And her story was as scandalous as it was tragic. You're listening to Fireside Canada, my podcast about Canadian legends, lies, and lore. I'm David Williams. Tonight, we'll examine a dubious and famous story about the Mink family, prominent Black Canadians who lived in Toronto during the mid-1800s. Their story, about a young woman who was sold into slavery by her husband, has been the topic of articles, history books, and even a motion picture. But recent research suggests that it might be far less factual than once believed, and its actual origins may surprise you. It's a story that shows how easy it can be for rumor, fabrication, and outright lies to become legends. And learning more about it can help us better understand the elements and the pitfalls of modern myth-making. This is the Myth of the Minks. Part 1. The Legend of Mary Mink. I want to preface this story by making this absolutely clear. What you're about to hear is a lie. Normally, I wouldn't be so forward. I would just tell the story and then walk through its history. But considering the unexpected origin of this particular tale, I wouldn't want to risk someone listening to only a portion of the episode and then walking away with the wrong impression. You'll find out why shortly. For now, just know that this is only a story. Then stick around to learn why knowing the difference between fact and fiction is, for this legend, especially important. James Mink was a man who seemed to have everything. A comfortable living in an elegant, well-appointed house, a loving family, the respect of the community, a fortune in real estate and small business holdings. He was truly one of Toronto's wealthiest citizens in more ways than one. By the late 1840s, most visitors to the city would have heard his name well before their feet even hit the sidewalk. It was on the cabs that carried them from Kingston, over the liveries where they would stable their horses, and on the doors of the stately Mansion House Hotel, a comfortable destination for weary travelers and a trusted polling center during elections. James was active in his city, well-liked among his peers, and enjoyed the favor of City Hall. His cabs were regularly used by Toronto's elite, including the mayor himself. Now, these accomplishments would have been impressive for anyone, but James Mink was the son of slaves. Starting from nothing, he used his wits, his exceptional business savvy, and decades of hard work to build a life that his parents had only dreamed about. That is, of course, what all parents want for their children: a better life. We hope that they will take what we have built and build upon it even further. James had that same hope for his only child, Mary. At 55 years of age, James was preparing to pass his legacy on to her, and it was a transition that, for James, was the cause of many sleepless nights. Though he was comforted by the fact that she had begun her young life somewhat sheltered and in a position of privilege, he also knew that the world would be unkind to one such as she, a young woman of color with a black father and a white mother. And he knew that these were struggles she would be facing alone all too soon. She had just turned 17, and though she was charmingly spirited, well-raised, well-educated, and even more beautiful than her mother, no suitors had come calling. James became increasingly worried as time went on, until he decided to act. It was that one simple act out of love and fear that would change their lives forever, and put Mary in more danger than he ever imagined. The Toronto newspapers regularly printed matrimonials, but never anything quite like what James Mink had penned, calling for a, quote, respectable white man, end quote, to marry his daughter in exchange for a $30,000 dowry. That was a shocking amount of money, the equivalent of roughly $1 million today. News of the eyebrow-raising advertisement quickly spread across the country, and soon a parade of gentlemen callers were knocking firmly but politely on their door. We can only imagine how many eligible bachelors crossed the elegant floors of the Mansion House Hotel, only to be sternly rebuffed by the discerning James Mink. Certainly there were schemers and scammers, fortune hunters and down-on-their-luck paupers playing as princes. No doubt there was a number of aristocrats, too, as wealthy as they were clueless, having never worked a day in their lives. In a way, James was searching for both a son-in-law and a successor. The right match would have the strength of character to accept Mary for who she was, to encourage her to pursue a higher education and her own career, if that's what she wanted, but he would also possess the skills and the smarts to run the cabs, tend the horses, and watch over the hotel and the family's investments. The young man would have to be born from the same class and of the same stature as Mary, but still know the value and the first-hand experience of a hard and honest day's work. James was starting to believe that no suitable candidate would ever be found, until one day when a man named James Andrews appeared in his doorway. As a cab driver, Andrews had done well for himself in the same career that allowed Mink to build his fortune. He was educated, courteous, and well-spoken, a true gentleman in every way, whose charms managed to impress both father and daughter. The courtship lasted a year, followed by a spectacular wedding. Andrews received the extraordinary dowry and, for a time, joined the Minks at their elegant mansion on Richmond Hill. Months later, tired of the cold of Toronto, Andrews proposed a honeymoon getaway to the southern United States, where he could look into a business opportunity and his new wife could enjoy the balmy warmth of the Southlands. Excited to begin her new life and see more of the world, Mary agreed. And James watched his only child ride away with her new husband, who, he believed, was a kind and honorable man. Spring brought the leaves and rain. Summer's heat cleaved off the top of the lake and spread it through the air, and autumn's wind turned that humidity into frost. And still, James heard nothing from his daughter or son-in-law. Until one day, the worst day of his life, when word finally reached him that Mary had been sold into slavery by the very man she had married, the man James had been so careful in choosing. The owner of a tobacco plantation in Virginia had purchased her for a sum of $1,500 and put her to work in his manor. Andrews had taken the money and vanished. James was mortified and desperate to recover his daughter, but the relationship between the two countries was strained, the wheels of bureaucracy turned slowly, and the concept that a woman of color could be something other than property was a challenge for some politicians and their economies. There are differences of opinion about what happened next. Some say that after several agonizing months or even an entire year, James finally secured the help of a British diplomat who arranged to buy Mary's freedom and bring her home to Toronto. Others maintain that James and his wife ventured alone to the southern states, she posing as a wealthy widow, he as her enslaved servant, risking their own freedom and possibly their lives to rescue their child. However it happened, Mary finally came home to Canada. But the villainous Andrews, now a rich man, was never seen or heard from again. I first learned of this story a few years ago while I was researching ideas for the podcast. It was the middle of February, Black History Month, and I thought it would be fun to look for stories about legendary and historical Black Canadians. Eventually, I came across a special feature on the CBC News website, written in 2013, titled 23 Historical Black Canadians You Should Know. There are some great stories out there of people like Josiah Henson, an enslaved American who escaped to Canada, founded a settlement and school for other fugitive slaves, and led a militia in the Upper Canada Rebellion. Or the folk hero and legendary cowboy John Ware, who was one of the most admired men in Calgary. Or Marie-Joseph Angelique, the enslaved woman who was tortured and hanged in Montreal for allegedly starting a fire, and who became a symbol of Black resistance and freedom. Any of those stories would have made for an interesting episode, but then I read the entry for James Mink, which talked about his Toronto hotel and stagecoach company, and then added this enticingly brief detail. Quote, later in his life, he posed as his Irish wife's slave in order to rescue their daughter, who had been sold into slavery by her husband, end quote. Now that was the stuff of legends. It was heroic, daring, and tragic, and a quick search online to verify the story suggested that it just might be true. To me, it seemed unbelievable, but it had the potential to become an incredible story. It turns out that I was right on both accounts. In April of 1996, a compelling TV movie was aired for the first time simultaneously on CanWest Global and CBS. Titled Captive Heart, The James Mink Story, the 91-minute historical drama stars Academy and Emmy Award-winning actor Louis Gossett Jr. in the titular role, and essentially tells the story you just heard. Here's the trailer.
Take good care of my daughter. Give her the love that she deserves.
James Mink, a man who never made mistakes.
$1,200. Do we have a sale or not?
Except one.
Father, William Johnson sold me as a slave.
Now, his only mission.
My daughter is being held against her will.
Is to get her back.
What happened to you?
Mink, he came after his daughter.
They're here. Find them.
Louis Gossett Jr., Captive Heart, The James Mink Story.
Captive Heart would receive generally favorable reviews and would be nominated for 6 Gemini Awards by the Academy of Canadian Cinema and Television. Canadian critics lauded it as a largely unknown part of our own history and a proud bit of history mythologized for U.S. consumption. The movie is beautifully shot, and the actors seem to give it their all. But perhaps the most striking thing about it, for critics and audiences alike, was the claim made in the opening credits. Quote, the following is taken from historical records, end quote. It's an interesting choice of words, replacing the more common based on or inspired by true events. It suggests that there are records of James Mink's harrowing journey into the lion's den to save his poor daughter, and it seems that many, including whoever wrote that piece for the CBC, were convinced that the Hollywood drama, produced in part by Hallmark Entertainment, was representative of historical fact. The movie was so emotionally stirring and so convincing that the incredible story persists to this day, mostly through online movie reviews, personal blogs, and posts on social media. But, much to the disappointment of those who were inspired to research the story further, the historical records say nothing about James Mink risking his own life to rescue his daughter. Instead, they claim that Mink sought the help of the British government, who eventually bought her back from her captors and returned her home on his behalf. It seems that the entire third act of the film was just a work of glossy fiction, designed to make James Mink seem more heroic and likable. This choice did not go over well with some viewers who called the movie a fairy tale and accused the real James Mink of being, quote, a despicable man and a coward, end quote, who equated success and prosperity with whiteness. The actor who played the role summarized it quite differently, quote, James Mink had to divest himself of what he was. He had to overcome racism and inequality, and to do that, he had to assume the personality of a Caucasian. He got to the point where he says, I don't know who I am anymore, end quote. The movie took other liberties too, all in the service of good storytelling. The dowry was never an exact figure and ranged from $10,000 to $40,000. The script set it at $30,000. And the duplicitous fiend who betrayed the Minks changed nationalities and occupations, from a British cab driver to an American horse dealer. Most confusing, perhaps, is his change in name from James Andrews in the papers to William Johnson on the screen. But really, does any of that matter? At this point, for me, the story of James and Mary Mink was still interesting, but not necessarily a good fit for a discussion about folklore and legends. It was too simple, more fitting for one of Canada's classic heritage moments, those commercial-length punches of patriotism with high drama and a simple story. Hollywood endings tacked on to historical dramas to make them more emotionally appealing are nothing new, and it seemed like this story could be quickly summarized and dismissed as a, quote, liberally embellished but essentially true tale of a pre-Confederation African-Canadian, end quote, as the Ottawa Citizen put it. Except, that's not true either. In fact, none of it's true. As I continued my research trying to separate fact from fiction, I realized that what we think we know about James and Mary Mink is not rooted in history, but in outright lies, racist tropes, and misleading propaganda. And it offers us a fascinating glimpse into how a modern myth can take shape through time and repetition, and yet remain malleable enough to fit the values of the storyteller and the era in which it's told. It is, in a word, adaptable. We'll get there, but first, let's start with the facts. Who were James and Mary Mink? Part 2. The Real James Mink. Most of the details about James Mink are shrouded in mystery. We don't even know what he looked like. If you search online long enough, you might see one photo that is regularly passed off as James Mink, but it's actually a photo of Bass Reeves, a legendary American lawman. But James Mink was a real person, there's no doubt about that. He was born in the late 1790s, most likely 1798, the son of an enslaved man. Some articles, retellings, and summaries claim that his father had escaped to Canada via the Underground Railroad and was free by the time James was born. But that's not true. James Mink's father was the slave of loyalist Johann Herkimer, who fled to Canada at the outbreak of the American Revolutionary War. Herkimer, along with all the other loyalists, were allowed to bring their slaves with them to Canada. Though England had outlawed enslavement in 1772, that decision did not apply to property rights in the colonies. In fact, according to the Canadian Encyclopedia, the government encouraged slave owners who were loyal to the king to flee the violence of the South and settle in Upper Canada. and to bring all of their possessions, enslaved humans included. Later, a legislative act in 1793 helped the abolitionist cause by restricting the slave trade, but it did nothing to actually help those who were currently enslaved. Under British law, the enslaved were simply chattel, locked in a life of servitude until their enslaver finally died. Enslaved children were to be freed upon the death of their enslaver or their 25th birthday, whichever came first. This meant that James, his seven surviving siblings, and their father, known only as Mink, remained the legal property of Johann Herkimer and then his wife, Mary, until her death in 1805 or 1806. Almost nothing of James Mink's early years are known, but historians like Guylaine Petrin tells us that by 1830, the Mink family was known and respected in the Kingston area. James would eventually marry a woman named Eliza Dennis, whose life is even more shrouded in mystery. The legend tells us that Eliza was a white woman, most likely of Irish descent, and many researchers seem to agree. Scholar Helena Bowes Wright, for example, points to census data showing Eliza was born in Quebec and self-identified as being of Irish descent. But that data, sourced in 1871 and 1880, seems to contradict an 1830 marriage certificate that one researcher found, which notes that both James and Eliza were black. Maybe James Mink married twice, or maybe there was an error in the research or the paperwork. We don't really know. James and Eliza had a daughter, Mary, born in Kingston in 1836. A few years later, James petitioned the city of Kingston for a carter's license and joined his brother George in the stagecoach and livery business. Though James was illiterate, he seemed to have a knack for business. By the time Mary was 10, the family owned a livery stable in Toronto, and a few years later, they had expanded their business with a new stagecoach line, additional liveries, and a hotel. Like in the legend, James was active and respected in the community. Travelers would often stay at his hotel, along with farmers from Richmond Hill and other areas outside the city who came to sell their goods at the market. The hotel was also a trusted polling station for local elections, and Torontonians routinely brought their horses, sleighs, and wagons to Mink's livery for repair. But while the Minks were certainly wealthy, they were never the millionaires the stories claimed them to be. They didn't live in a swanky mansion on Richmond Hill, but a fine little home on Danforth Road. According to Guylaine Petrin, one report estimated James' worth to be between $10,000 and $30,000, mostly in real estate. That was an impressive amount for anyone, let alone a man who began his life with almost nothing. But it means that, if the stories are true, James would have had to sell every last asset, every square inch of land, and scrape together every penny he had just to pay for his daughter's legendary dowry. And here's where the threads of fact and legend really begin to separate. According to official records and newspaper announcements, Mary Mink was wed to a man named William Johnson on October 5, 1852. He wasn't a guileful British cabman from Yorkshire, nor a treacherous white American horse dealer who dabbled in the slave trade. He was, in reality, a seemingly normal black man who was born in Tennessee and found his way north. Mary and William had a child together and lived in Toronto until 1868, when the family moved to Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where William found work at a hotel. James Mink died that same year at age 70, with Mary tragically passing less than a decade later in 1876, surrounded by friends and family. These are the historical facts, laid out most clearly in historian Guylaine Petrin's essay, The Myth of Mary Mink. She and other historians agree that there is no reliable evidence to suggest that James Mink sought a white son-in-law. There's no evidence that he ever offered an outrageous dowry. And there's certainly no evidence that his daughter Mary was ever sold into slavery or died poor and alone on the streets of Chicago. Yet the legend is so compelling, so dramatic, and so ubiquitous that people are still arguing online about whether James Mink relied on the government to buy back his daughter or disguised himself as a slave in a death-defying attempt to rescue her. An argument which depicts both father and daughter in an unfair and unflattering light. The family who, by all accounts, should be celebrated and respected as some of early Canada's most successful people of color, are instead lamented as tragic figures who bent to the values of a prejudiced society and lost their way. All thanks, seemingly, to a work of fiction. But if the classic story of James and Mary Mink is indeed fiction, where did the story come from, and why is it still being told? Part 3. The Tragic Tale of Minnie Mink and Other Stories. Let's go back to that opening story about the mysterious woman in Chicago. At 11 a.m. on June 13, 1880, a 36-year-old woman was found dead in her home. A local doctor who had been attending her signed her death certificate, noting that she died of diphtheria. Her name was Nellie Jones. In the obituary the next day, the Chicago Tribune declared that Nellie, an interracial woman, quote, appears to have had no friends or relatives hereabouts, and the body has been taken in charge by the county undertaker. Her effects, consisting of about $50 worth of furniture, have been taken charge of by the county agent, end quote. That was the end of the story, until 2 weeks later, on June 30th, when the Chicago Times revealed that Nellie Jones had a surprising and tragic past. The name Nellie Jones was just an alias, it said. Thanks to the sleuthing skills of a diligent Times reporter, the paper learned that the woman who had died alone on a, quote, miserable cot in a hovel, end quote, was none other than Minnie Mink, the prepossessing and eminently educated daughter of the late James Mink, Toronto's wealthy stagecoach and livery tycoon. The article goes on to tell the well-trod legend that James Mink, quote, conceived the notion of marrying his daughter to a white man, and knowing that no Caucasian under ordinary circumstances was willing to take a woman of color for a wife, the old gentleman offered as an inducement the sum of $20,000 to be paid to any respectable white man who would accept the hand of his daughter, end quote. According to the article, an Englishman and stagecoach driver from Kingston answered the call, took her to Virginia, sold her to a plantation owner, and fled back to England with his ill-gotten riches. James Mink eventually learned of the deception and worked with Sir Henry Bulwer, the British consul in Norfolk, Virginia, to secure her release. What supposedly happened next was left out of many future stories, including the TV movie Captive Heart. Quote, she reached home broken-hearted, weary, and suffering in mind and body, and for many weeks she was confined to the house. As soon as she was able to move, she left home and visited Elmira, New York, where she remained for some time, seeming to have lost all love for home and its surroundings. Minnie became wayward, it is claimed. She floated about from one city to another under the alias of Nellie Jones, finally bringing up on the west side, taking a small cottage, and paying for it by doing laundry work. It was here that she died. The daughter of wealth, the slave, the pauper. Her neighbors always thought there was something strange about Miss Jones, but they never penetrated her secret, end quote. We know now, thanks to the work of diligent historians, that in all likelihood, this entire story is nonsense. So you might be wondering, how did an intrepid and diligent reporter of the Chicago Times get this scandalous information? If, on the other hand, you couldn't care less, then congratulations! You might have what it takes to be the editor of a 19th century newspaper. Papers across the continent had a field day reprinting the story, calling it, quote, a romance of the old slavery days revived, end quote, happily libeling the Mink family, Nellie Jones, and, one assumes, some random Englishman named James Andrews. Some papers changed the father's name from James to Joseph in their reprint, perhaps doubting the veracity of the claim, but not wanting to miss the opportunity to print a juicy story. Finer details were added, and some changes were made, perhaps to make the story more believable. Some said Minnie was married at 17, others at 22. Other papers put a date to her marriage, saying that Minnie had wed her double-crossing husband in 1858, a full 6 years after her well-documented union with a black man named William Johnson. The dowry was all over the place, too, from $10,000 to $30,000. One Chicago paper even claimed that James Mink promised the newlywed couple their weight in silver. At least two newspapers did try to set the record straight. Ghislaine Petrin points out that on July 2, 1880, the same day that the Toronto Mail joined in on the libelous fun, the Toronto Evening Telegram printed a rebuttal to the quote-unquote lurid tale. The tiny article, likely crammed onto the bottom of page 4 right before printing, lists all of the true facts that you've already heard. Minnie was actually named Mary. She married an employee of her father's named Johnson, and after a short stay in the city, went to Milwaukee, etc., etc. The article's author pulls no punches at the end, writing, quote, "The Chicago story is therefore a huge myth and a gross libel on the Mink family. Miss Mink received an excellent education and was most accomplished, and her father was a man respected by every Torontonian," end quote. The British Whig followed suit at the end of the month, summarizing, quote, "In short, Minnie Mink did not marry one Andrews. She was not sold into slavery, and she did not lead a loose life. Neither did she die the other day in Chicago," end quote. Despite these fact-filled rebuttals, the story stuck. By 1894, John Ross Robertson included the lie in his classic and respected work, Landmarks of Toronto, despite the fact that he was the publisher of one of the papers that exposed it as a lie to begin with. The multi-volume work was regularly used by later historians, and the legend of Mary Mink's dowry, marriage, and enslavement grew so large that the truth was lost in its shadow. Almost a century later, the historian Daniel G. Hill helped to further transform the fiction into history by including it in his important and comprehensive book, The Freedom Seekers, Blacks in Early Canada. Though Hill left out the tragic details of the demise of Nellie Jones, it seems his source for the story can be traced directly to that questionable article printed in the Chicago Times back in 1880. So that's how the myth of the Minks was popularized, but the story seems to go back even further. The language used in many of the newspapers back in 1880 seemed to suggest that readers would have already been familiar with the tale, likely spread as gossip. According to historian Ghislaine Petrin, the elements of the myth may have been especially common in Toronto's black community in the mid-1800s, while the details may have changed with each telling. She quotes one resident, writer Agnes Chamberlain, who later recalled that gossip that she had heard. Quote, "Mink had said he would give his daughter $5,000 if she married a white man and $10,000 if she married a white gentleman. The poor girl did neither. She married a man of color, but not very pronounced color. Mink was furious, refusing to give her anything, whereupon the husband, who had probably married her for her money, took her south and sold her. Poor old Mink was brokenhearted. He dare not go to the States to buy her back, as he was a runaway slave himself, but he sent someone who bought her back for $3,000. End quote. The most striking differences here are that a dowry was offered but not awarded, and that the husband was black. Following these clues, we might trace the story's origins to an equally unsubstantiated article, this time printed in the Hamilton Spectator on March 19, 1853. Earlier that month, a member of a prominent white family, Harvey Smith, had been accused of kidnapping two black youths and selling them into slavery. A few weeks later, the Hamilton Spectator printed an article titled "More Kidnapping," alleging that, according to, quote, "particulars of our Toronto exchanges," end quote, a dashing young American black man, quote, "came over to Toronto and married the daughter of a respectable colored citizen, but receiving no money with her as he expected, went off to the southern states and there sold her into slavery. The father of the young woman is now left to find his daughter and will probably have to purchase her in the slave markets of the south," end quote. Petrin suggests that this news item, with its conspicuous lack of names or sources, was meant to justify Smith's conduct. That certainly seems to be the case, with the article's author concluding, and I'll paraphrase the uglier language here, quote, "When such acts are perpetrated by people of color themselves, we cease to wonder at Mr. Harvey Smith attempting to make money by an operation in which a black man is as expert as the white man," end quote. Finally, you'd think such a sensational story about, in the words of the article, an even greater atrocity than Harvey's alleged crimes would have been all over the Toronto papers. But that doesn't seem to be the case. Despite an exhaustive search, Petrin was unable to find any reference to this apparent kidnapping in Toronto newspapers from the time. The original Hamilton Spectator piece was, on the other hand, picked up and commented upon, not by other Canadian papers, but by both pro-slavery and pro-abolition newspapers in the United States. To one group, it helped justify enslavement and demonstrate that the enslaved were better off being protected by their white owners. To the other, it demonstrated nothing less than absolute equality, showing that all humans can be equally inhumane. So did this article directly lead to the false myth of James and Mary Mink? There's a good chance. Though the victim and her respectable citizen father are never named, the Mink family would have been one of the most prominent people of color in the city at the time, making them an easy target for public speculation. In addition, Petrin suggests that the article may have influenced another writer whose work has been directly linked to the myth of the Minks. In 1889, a Toronto lawyer and amateur anthropologist named James Cleland Hamilton managed to trace the infamous rumor to its possible source. It comes, he said, from a now long-forgotten serialized novel titled Norman Sinclair, written by Scottish attorney, author, and poet William Edmonstone Aytoun, and published in Blackwood's Edinburgh Magazine in 1860. The story, which takes up the entire second chapter, is titled The Smartest Man in Creation, and is framed as a story within a story, told to the main character as an amusing tale over dinner. Since this is a podcast, let me just say, that word amusing should have the biggest quotation marks around it, because in this overwhelmingly racist story, which really no one should read, the man who sells his wife into slavery is framed as the hero, the titular smartest man in creation. The basic narrative matches all of the same beats of the myth in question, refraining from using real names, but casting the father as a prominent Toronto horse dealer and black Canadian, and the kidnapper as a clever white American con artist. Petrin suggests that Aytoun, the story's author, may have drawn inspiration from that questionable article in the Hamilton Spectator, writing, quote, "It was not unusual for articles published in anti-slavery papers to be read and influence the way pro-slavery articles were written, both in newspapers and in novels." Similarly, it would make sense for Aytoun to use articles published in anti-slavery papers to invent a pro-slavery narrative, end quote. Even if that isn't the case, Blackwood's, the publication that printed his story, was, according to Petrin, quote, "widely read and believed in Toronto," end quote. Combine that with a potentially influential news story from Hamilton, a town just 70 kilometers down the road or along the lake, and it's easy to see how the Mink family would have been associated with some particularly ugly rumors. Here's where it gets crazy. Part 4. Tropes, Tragedies, and Twisted Histories. If all of what I said is true, that means we can trace this one story from its potential genesis in a dubious article meant to justify a prominent white Canadian's alleged crime, to an anti-black story in a conservative journal, then to both pro-abolition and pro-slavery newspapers in the lead-up to the American Civil War, and then to a sensational article in a Chicago newspaper. From there, it gets included in prominent Canadian history books found in schools, and is finally recreated in an award-winning TV movie that, just a few years ago, could still be found in the bargain bin at your local Walmart and in matinee showings on the Hallmark Channel. That's what I meant when I described the myth of the Minks as adaptable. It's a story that is infinitely tellable, changing with each era to reflect the values and beliefs of the storyteller. At a time when our southern neighbors were about to rip themselves apart, stories like the one found in the Hamilton Spectator were used by both sides to push pro-slavery and anti-slavery perspectives. In the 1880s, as black citizens continued to push for more civil rights, and just before the first Jim Crow laws were formed to enforce racial segregation across the United States, the story surfaced again. This time, the story of Minnie Mink dying poor and alone in a Chicago shack drew inspiration from the well-known racist literary trope of the tragic mulatto. In this myth, people of interracial heritage find themselves to be barred from fully integrating in both black and white society. Existing as outcasts, they're forced to restlessly wander the world, live on the margins, and ultimately die alone, serving as a dire warning of the supposed dangers of interracial unions. While readers in the 1800s may have labeled the myth of the Minx as a romance with a capital R, modern audiences are more likely to regard it as a tragedy with a capital T. Traditionally, tragedy involves a great person who experiences a reversal in fortune brought about by some tragic personal flaw and action, resulting in a downfall brought about by a higher power, usually the gods, fate, or society. Aristotle tells us that an audience experiencing the dramatic performance of the fall of a king or noble will feel vicarious fear and pain, and thus experience catharsis, a sort of pleasurable purging of negative emotion. That could be why many storytellers, including the writers of Captive Heart, chose to exaggerate the Minx's wealth. The higher the fall, the greater the tragedy. As Louis Gossett Jr., the actor who played James Mink, pointed out, his character, a man of privilege, attempted to fully join the ruling class of white society and was struck down and humbled by the ways of the world. He was required to live the experience of a slave in order to save his child after forgetting, quote, what his father had gone through, end quote. Playwright Arthur Miller offers a more modern perspective on tragedy that still fits the story. Miller argued that tragedy was as much the realm of the common man as it was of kings, noting that the underlying struggle of a tragedy is an individual's attempt to gain what they feel is their rightful place in society. Tragedy, he wrote, is the consequence of a man's total compulsion to evaluate himself justly. And to many modern audiences, that is exactly what James Mink was trying to do. Thankfully, these days most Canadians believe in the importance of equality and anti-racism. So when modern audiences hear the myth of James and Mary Mink, we're right there empathizing with them in the drama and demanding justice, agreeing that they should be the absolute equals of other Canadians, feeling the heartbreak when Mary fails to attract appropriate suitors, feeling outrage when her father tries to essentially purchase a white husband, feeling shock when she is betrayed by the evil man, and feeling fear when James learns that his own daughter has been enslaved. Things can start to get a little uncomfortable, however, when we see echoes of ourselves in the antagonist, as part of a nation which, not too long ago, discouraged interracial relationships and welcomed slave owners with open arms. Perhaps that's why some storytellers are so eager to change some of the details and focus on others, like making James Mink the son of a freed or escaped slave, emphasizing that the evil husband was an outsider and either British or American rather than Canadian-born, or fabricating new, happier endings. One history book, published in 2002, tells us matter-of-factly, quote, James Mink, guilt-ridden over what he had done, built for his daughter a huge estate on the Danforth overlooking the Don River, where she lived out her life in the lap of luxury, end quote. The makers of Captive Heart tacked on a crowd-pleasing happy ending with the Mink family crossing the Ohio River into a free state. According to an article in the Ottawa Citizen, the original ending, before budget cuts, intended to show, quote, the joyful family crossing a suspension bridge over Niagara Falls into the Promised Land, end quote. An ending that the article's author suggests, quote, might have caused many Canadians to blush, end quote. And that is, I think, another reason why this tale continues to be told. It works so well with our broader national myths. It's a bit of a pastime in Canada to compare ourselves favorably to the US in everything from history to culture to politics, leading to some people, Canadians and foreigners alike, saying things like, "Well, I know Canada's not perfect, but at least they're not like the US." For example, it has long been a common myth that Canada had no slavery. Case in point, Dorothy Petrie, the American producer of Captive Heart, told the Canadian press, quote, "One of the things that interested me about the story is that you in Canada, which I applauded, abolished slavery in the 1700s, end quote. But we know that's not true. Canada was simply quieter about it. Slave owners used euphemisms like servants and extended family when referring to the enslaved, and the cooler climate didn't allow for lucrative cotton, sugar, and tobacco plantations powered by slave labor. James Mink's father accompanied loyalist slave owners like any other piece of property. It wouldn't be until 1833, just 3 decades before the U.S. would abolish slavery, that all people of African descent would be legally free." When a reporter wondered if the movie would give some Canadians a false sense of moral superiority, the producer disagreed, noting that the Minks marriage would have been illegal in the U.S., while here in Canada, quote, "it wasn't even considered particularly scandalous," end quote. Legal or not, we can see just through the perpetuation of the myth that there were deep racial anxieties in Canada that lingered for a long time. With our proud history of serving as the terminus for the Underground Railroad, it's too easy to imagine Canada as the free, tolerant, inclusive, promised land envisioned in the movie's original ending. But the truth is, after an act in 1793 failed to free anyone, many enslaved people actually fled south across the border to the northern United States, where the governments there actually had abolished slavery. It feels good to think about how people of color like James Mink could thrive in Canadian cities like Toronto, while others were struggling so much more in the South. But it's important to note that the Minks succeeded not because of, but in spite of, the dominant culture. People like the Minks should be Canadians of note, not because they demonstrate the wonderfulness of Canada as a political entity, but because they were Canadians who struggled and succeeded in the face of misfortune and prejudice in a hard and unforgiving land. Of course, there are positive elements to these kinds of national myths too. Provided that we keep one eye on the truth while the other is fixed on the ideal, as we gauge how far we still need to go. Myths can represent a community's collective vision, a representation of who we want to be. In this case, a place where anyone can succeed with equal opportunity, no matter their past, their class, or the color of their skin. And that is a noble goal. Today, as we grow increasingly introspective and grapple with the darker parts of our history, other falsehoods are appearing in the myth of the Minks. Like the claim that James Mink lost everything he owned and essentially gave up after an arsonist set fire to his livery and hotel in 1858. While it's true that a fire devastated much of their business, the wording suggests that the Minks were deliberately targeted. They weren't. The fire first broke out at a neighboring shop and spread to the other buildings. James never returned to the hotel business, but quickly built a livery at a new location. Other retellings claim that James's wife, Eliza, left him shortly after the devastation. That is also untrue. As far as we can tell, Eliza stayed with her husband until his death a decade later. He was buried in the non-denominational Toronto Necropolis Cemetery in Cabbage Town. Eliza signed his death certificate, then moved to Wisconsin to live with her grandson and Mary's son, William. Now that historians like Ghislaine Petrin have done all the hard work in putting this legend to rest, it seems like it's about time we stop using the Minks to express our various anxieties and give them back their lives. Because stories like the myth of the Minks can distract from the true histories of Black Canadians and diminish their actual lived experiences. We should admire them not for their fictional struggles, but their factual strength. That's it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening and for joining me in becoming part of a Canadian folk tradition. Now that you know the story, share it. And remember, don't believe everything that you read or see. Sometimes the real truth is buried far below the surface. Fireside Canada is written and recorded by me, David Williams, with sound design by Braden Alexander. Stephanie Phillips is our showrunner. Mary Jubrin is our digital editor. Diana Key is our business manager. Jordan Heath Rawlings is our executive producer. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider giving this podcast a positive review. If you want to help even further, you can provide story ideas and more through my website. Every little bit helps to keep the fire burning and the library of legends growing. Learn more at firesidecanada.ca.